And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our show, it's Midday at the Movies with Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post and Jed Dietz, the founder of the Maryland Film Festival. Plus, our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick, will review a new online production at the Everyman Theater here in Baltimore. So that's all coming up tomorrow here on Midday. And now I am very pleased to welcome back to the show Dr. Julie Shiblitsky, an archaeologist with the Maryland Department of Transportation, who led a team that recently discovered important new information about the father of Harriet Tubman, an enslaved man named Ben Ross. 5 years after his enslaver died, Ben was freed and left some land in what is now the Blackwater Wildlife Refuge. Dr. Julie's team has found where Ben Ross had a home on this land, and she joins us on Zoom to talk about this very significant discovery. Dr. Julie, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be back.
So let's kind of start at the end. We'll talk about what you found and where you found it and how you got there. But talk first about the importance of this discovery. This really is a significant find. What will we learn from what you and your team discovered at this site?
I think both the search as well as the discovery gives us this opportunity to look at Harriet Tubman in a different light. So many of us see her as this kind of more elderly woman and this, you know, great hero who led her people to freedom. But we don't really know that much about her childhood or what she did when she was a young woman. And I think this discovery gives us that opportunity to kind of look at her in a different light and try and understand what her life would have been like. And really what gave her and what and who influenced her to become the woman she became.
And you have found where her father lived. He was freed at that time, but she was not. Is that right?
Well, it's kind of an interesting situation because in 1836, the person who enslaved him, Anthony Thompson, wrote in his will that upon his death, Ben would receive 10 acres and eventually his freedom in that 5 years. So we think around 1840 or so, he was legally free. But we do believe he did have a cabin where he lived and was given that 10 acres when we first began the search, somewhere in this place where Anthony Thompson, this property that he owned. So what we wanted to do is try and figure out where he lived, and how we did that was a very methodical method. It was both archaeology, historical research, and trying to read the landscape.
And what did Ben do for a living? What was his occupation when he inhabited this cabin?
Well, I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, we weren't just tobacco growers in Maryland. Eventually, as we came closer and closer to the Civil War time period, we got away from tobacco, and a lot of Maryland began to look at grain if they weren't already there already. But interestingly enough, what Anthony Thompson did is his money and his focus was on harvesting timber in that part of Dorchester County. So he had Ben Ross. He was the leader of this group of people who would go out into the woods and choose different stands to be cut down. And that timber then would be somehow manufactured. Either if they had a mill, they would have milled it, or just taken logs themselves and would have moved them up through a canal and along the Blackwater River. And that was his job. He was a leader. He was looked at by the community, both white and black, as someone who had a lot of integrity. He was well-known and well-trusted by everyone.
And so is it assumed then that Harriet, whose name was Amanita, I guess, right, when she was a child, worked with her father in that regard, you know, in the timber trade? Or do we know what Harriet and her father did together and how long a period of time they would have been together when Ben had this land and this cabin?
So the interesting thing here is that Anthony Thompson owned Ben Ross, and she and Harriet Tubman and her mother were there at the property because they were owned by Mary Brodus. Mary Brodus and Anthony Thompson were married. Mary Brodus ended up passing away, and her property, and that included both Harriet Tubman and her mother, Rit, went with Edward Brodus, and he lived at Bucktown. So Harriet Tubman was only on the Anthony Thompson farm until she was only a year or 2 years old. So she wasn't there very long, but this was a community that kept in touch. You know, people who were enslaved didn't just stay on their farm or on their plantation. They had the ability to move around. They were married to people on different parcels of property and owned by different people. And so in this sort of situation, what happened was Harriet Tubman had lived away from her father for many years, but when she became a teenager, she went back and, in a sense, kind of hired herself out to work alongside of Ben in this timber operation. So we know that her mother and maybe even some of her brothers lived at this Ben Ross location. So she would work alongside her father as a teenage woman until around 1840 or so.
Dr. Julie Shiblitsky is an archaeologist. She's the chief of the Cultural Resources Division at the Maryland Department of Transportation. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take any calls and comments. So, Dr. Julie, tell us a little bit about the Blackwater Wildlife Refuge for listeners who haven't been there. I've been there a couple times. It's just beautiful. But where is it and what does it comprise?
Yeah, the Blackwater Wildlife Refuge is an amazing parcel of land that it's unlike any other place I've ever been. It's woodlands, it's wetlands, it's waterfowl. There's sitka deer, which are these interesting kind of mini elk that came from, I think it was in Asia, maybe Japan, sometime in the 20th century. And there are these unique sounds that are in the forest when you hear them whistle. So it's this very, very wild, natural, almost untouched part of Dorchester County. And I think what's interesting about this environment is that it's as if it's the land that time forgot, because it's so easy to make us think about what it would have been like for Harriet Tubman to live there and along with her family. This was a training ground with just the wetlands and the woods and her father instilling this knowledge of how to negotiate and navigate through such nature. I think it really gives us an idea of what gave her the tools, what place she grew up in that would give her those tools to be able to move her people to freedom.
So the Fish and Wildlife Service acquired this property for the Blackwater Wildlife Refuge, which is huge. It's 30,000 acres. And they somehow knew that Ben Ross's home was there somewhere. How did they know? How did they have a hunch that the cabin that Ben Ross lived in was located somewhere in the Blackwater Wildlife Refuge?
Well, Anthony Thompson's farm included over 1,000 acres. And just from historical research, we knew, and the Fish and Wildlife Service knew, that somewhere in this parcel along Harrisville Road was Ben Ross's cabin. And they believed that it was very possible, based on historical record search, that it could be sitting there on the location where of the land that they just purchased. And the way they know this is from both land deeds and also within the will of Anthony Thompson. They talk about Ben Ross giving 10 acres along this road near this landing. They talk about where from the fields this parcel would be. So in the beginning, we had a search area. We knew the approximate location, but the only way that we could find out where X marks a spot is through using archaeology.
And why did they reach out to you? I mean, this is the Fish and Wildlife Service. They're the owners of this property. How did they decide to get the Maryland Department of Transportation and you as an archaeologist involved?
That's a great question. Well, the reason that we were asked is because we have a history and of looking for and having a lot of success on finding and excavating African-American sites in Maryland. We have Belvoir, which is located just in Crownsville, which was a location of a wonderful, well-built place where people who were enslaved lived. We also had just recently finished working in Cambridge, trying to figure out if the Bailey Cabin was a place where enslaved people lived. So they knew from our reputation of doing African-American archaeology in Maryland that we had a pretty good track record. And if anybody could find it, it would be us.
So you had a general idea of where it was, but you were also under a great deal of time pressure because of sea level rise, right? I mean, there were parts of the refuge, there are parts of the refuge that are very much in danger of being engulfed by water. So if you didn't find this at the right time, this might not have worked out well. Talk about the pressure you and your team felt because of climate change.
Yeah, sea level rise is threatening archaeological sites across the world. And because so much of Maryland is surrounded by water, we're even under even more intense pressure. Part of the reason that the Fish and Wildlife Service even acquired this part of Dorchester County is to try and protect that part of the county and these wetlands. But what seems to be happening at the location where we were digging is that there is indeed sea level rise. There's, in a sense, a race against time, where the water seems to be not just coming into the location where Ben Ross's cabin is, but it's also coming up into. What that means is that when we excavate down in our 5-foot by 5-foot excavation units and we dig into the soil, if we step away for a day or two, that groundwater will seep into our units and inundate where we had been digging. And that's a big problem for archaeologists, because we use this stratigraphy, the layers of soil, to control where we're digging and what we're finding. I mean, that's of utmost importance, and that's really where the science comes into. So if we don't have that, all we have is a muddy hole that we have artifacts, and we don't know if they're coming from 1700 or 1800, or if they're associated with this occupation or that occupation. Now, in the case of Ben Ross's site, we're in more trouble because sea level rise is encroaching into that parcel where the site's located. So within the next several years, we're not going to be able to excavate it properly. But it's not only just the site being inundated, it's the access to the location. There were some days in the field where we had to call off the search because we just physically couldn't make it in with our 4-wheel drive vehicles. So yeah, it's a big problem everywhere.
Dr. Julie Shiblitsky is an archaeologist and the chief of the Cultural Resources Division at the Maryland Department of Transportation. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Dr. Julie about this amazing quest that she and her team undertook to find the cabin that was owned by Harriet Tubman's father. It's an incredible story. Again, our conversation was pre-recorded, so we aren't able to take any calls or comments. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Dr. Julie Shiblitsky, an archaeologist with the Maryland Department of Transportation. She led a team that recently discovered the site of Harriet Tubman's father's house on the eastern shore at the Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge. Our conversation was recorded last week, so we can't take any calls or comments. So, Dr. Julie, tell us where this quest started, when you started, and what the first things you had to do to narrow down this large expanse of potential locations for Ben Ross's cabin. How did you narrow it down and find eventually the exact location?
We began the search last November, and the search area was created from looking at historic maps. Where had people lived? Where were they living? Where were the communities? And we also had both land deeds and a will that gave us general locations of where Ben Ross could be located, where his home would have been. And so using this historical information and knowing that what's an agricultural field today was probably what was farmed back then, we stayed away from those locations and looked at other areas that seemed to have been able to, they weren't ideal for agriculture, and therefore they were probably given to people who were enslaved and would have been given to Ben Ross. We also know that Ben Ross would have been working in the wooded area. So that made sense for us to look in that location as well. So once we had a general search area, that's when we took out the shovels and began to dig. So we had 2 weeks to find general location of where he may have lived. Now, the problem is that since this was an area that had people lived on it for years, there was a real high probability that we'd be finding 19th century artifacts all over the place. But that wasn't the case. As we began to dig hole after hole after hole with a dozen archaeologists, we began to realize that this wasn't as easy as we thought. Each hole, muddy hole that we hit was coming up empty for artifacts, nothing, not even any from the 20th century, really. So as we're digging and digging, I began to get really frustrated and ask myself, well, where is it? Where could it be? And to use another tool, I reached into my vehicle and pulled out my metal detector. Metal detectors are great for finding sites that have obviously iron or any sort of brass artifacts on them. So I was looking specifically for rusty nails, any sort of hardware that would tell me that there was a building nearby. So as I began to walk along the road and sweep my metal detector, within the first 5 minutes, I had a hit and I stopped. I took a look at it and dug it. And I thought I was going to get maybe a spent shotgun shell or even, you know, something that was modern along the road. But in fact, what popped up was a coin. And I didn't think much of it, but as I was rubbing the mud off it, I looked at it and there was a crown that said Liberty on it. And it was a 50-cent piece with the Lady Liberty on it. And the date was 1808. And it was kind of a eureka moment because it told me I'm getting closer. Our team is doing the work and we're getting to where we need to be. And 1808 is a powerful date because that was the year that Harriet Tubman's parents were married and began a family. So to me, that was a bit of an omen, perhaps from Harriet herself, that, you know, you're getting close, keep going.
Yeah, and that places, you know, certainly that area in exactly the time period you want. But boy, the emotional roller coaster of this for you and your team, it's just got to be incredible. I mean, when you started digging these holes, I guess you call them test pits, is that right?
Yeah, they're called shovel test pits. They're about a foot and a half in diameter, and it's simply a quick and dirty hole that you dig. You screen for artifacts and look for the presence or absence of artifacts. And from there, that tells you whether you have something to concentrate on. And at the end of those 2 weeks in November, what we ended up finding is that one coin told us that we're getting close. And a day or two later, what we ended up finding are little bits of broken white ceramic plate sherds. And that doesn't sound like that's that exciting, but what is a broken plate doing in the middle of a wooded area? And could this be perhaps Ben Ross's cabin or associated with his cabin? And because it was in the right time frame, that 19th century, and since we hadn't found anything else in our search area, it was worth coming back to. But just finding a couple of artifacts doesn't tell us as archaeologists and scientists that we have really anything. That's why we had to return in the spring.
And of course, this is after you, I mean, these holes, you had to dig like 1,000 of them, right? I mean, it's not like you stuck the shovel in the ground a few times and, you know, came up empty and then you got your metal detector. I mean, you had to have incredible patience. And of course, that's probably the biggest characteristic that you and your colleagues need to bring to your profession. But I mean, you had to just dig and dig and dig and dig. And then the metal detector finds this coin. I mean, that must have been an incredible moment for you.
Yeah, it was definitely a eureka moment where after you've dug almost 1,000 holes in this wet, wooded, swampy area, and you're coming up empty, 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 and finally having the coin that says, keep going. And then finally, within a day or two, we end up popping up artifacts from the time period we're looking at, looking for. That it was a relief because I had told everyone, if it's there, we'll find it with such confidence. And then that's why I had no choice. Like, we had to find it. And it meant digging in places where we didn't even think it was. And that ended up being the location where it happened to be.
Dr. Julie Shablitsky is an archaeologist with the Maryland Department of Transportation. We're talking about her recent discovery, her and her team, of the cabin owned by Ben Ross, Harriet Tubman's father. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Again, our conversation was recorded last week, so we're not able to take calls and comments today with Dr. Shablitsky. So, Julie, your next thing to do then happened in the spring. Is that because it was just too cold and the ground was too hard in December and January? Why did you put things off from prior to the first of the year until the following spring?
Yeah, as archaeologists, there are certain windows of time when you want to dig, when you don't want to dig. When you're in that part of Dorchester County, you want to try and avoid the hottest time of the year because not only of the heat, but also the biting flies, the mosquitoes. This is a very uncomfortable place to be in the swamps of Dorchester County during that time period. So we try to time our searches in the fall when a lot of the brush is down and the bugs are gone, or in the very, very early spring. When we returned in March, we knew there was an approximate location to excavate in. And so we took about a dozen archaeologists down back into the swamp, into the place where we're finding these little bits of broken white ceramic plate, and began to open up larger 5-foot by 5-foot excavation units. Because if there was a domestic home place there, those test units would tell us that. And sure enough, we dug one open and that big hole revealed all sorts of interesting artifacts. We were able to find more broken bits of plates, medicine bottle fragments, even a Prosser porcelain button, which dates to around 1840. We had bits of pipe stems, smoking tobacco pipe stems, bowls, the personal artifacts, the domestic artifacts, everything you need to tell us that someone's living here. So that was a great, great first find. But then we wanted to know more. What about a building? Was there evidence of a building here? So we began to open up one and then another, and brick began to show up. Large pieces of brick, small bits of brick, rusty nails that were so corroded from the sea level rise and it being wet and inundated for so long. But they were there. There was that evidence that there was someone's home in this location. And a lot of times people ask, well, what did the building look like? What did the home look like? And we don't know for sure. We don't know how big it was. It was at least 10-foot by 10-foot, of course. But it may have been a little bit bigger, 12 by 16, and it was likely made out of wood and would have sat on brick piers. And that's what we know of it thus far. We haven't dug everything up.
Yeah, so this is an ongoing project then.
Yes, it's an ongoing project, and we've only excavated the edge of it. We're hoping to return in the fall and excavate a little bit more to tell us, hopefully it'll tell us more about the distribution of the site. We have a building, we probably have the home site. Well, we do have the home site, but do we have an outbuilding? Do we have a barn? Do we have other sort of structures that would have supported this dwelling?
And these grids that you construct, you said they're about 5 by 5, is that right?
Yeah, they're excavation units. So it's a 5 by 5 foot square hole. And once we excavate that down, we'll lay out another one next to it, either to the north or the west, the east or the south, depending on where the artifacts are coming from or what we're finding. So the more excavation units we open, the larger our window into the past becomes. So that's why we want to return, so that we can open up this excavation unit, all the excavation units, I believe, in a little bit more.
How many artifacts have you found so far?
We found, I'd say, a couple hundred artifacts. They
wow,
are now still in the bags. Yeah, it's a lot, but they're small and they're broken up from just being trampled. But as we get farther into the wooded area, it seems like they're whole and they're a little bit larger. But we have evidence of there being redware jars and bowls. We have a yellowware chamber pot where, you know, somebody would use it to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night and then dump it out in the morning. We have evidence of medicine bottles. We have evidence of people smoking the tobacco pipes, which is kind of interesting because it could have been Harriet's bowl, but it also could have been Ben's. We just don't know yet. And it'd be interesting to be able to find that out. But at this time, we don't know. There's an interesting tool that we use in science now where we look at these personal objects like tobacco pipe stems and try to lift DNA from those objects. And in this case, if it's preserved, that DNA can tell us whether a man or a woman smoked the tobacco pipe. And if it was a woman, it could just very well be Harriet Tubman's.
Ah, wouldn't that be cool? So what's the long-term vision for this site? How can folks find out more about it? What do you see happening at the spot where Ben Ross's cabin once stood?
Well, because it's so hard to reach, I don't think that it'll ever be a place where the public can go and visit that exact location. But there's this great application called, it's the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway. And it's, if you go there and take the byway, you can stop at all these different sites along the way in that part of Dorchester County, starting even in Cambridge. So it's, I encourage everyone to go ahead, and even if you just Google the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway, you'll be able to look and explore that virtually. Now, I'm hoping someday that the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to be able to raise the money to construct some sort of interpretive signage and maybe even something like augmented reality so that people in a way can time travel with their phones to be able to visit this site. And then we'll also have photographs of the site. We'll have photographs of the artifacts there at that interpretive area. But we're also hoping these artifacts are going to end up in the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Visitor Center there just outside of Cambridge. So we're very, very excited about that.
Well, Dr. Julie, congratulations to you and your team. This is an incredibly important discovery. We've learned so much about Harriet Tubman, and there's a lot more to learn about this amazing figure in history thanks to your incredible work. So thank you so much for that work and for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Julie Shablitsky is the chief of the Cultural Resources Division at the Maryland Department of Transportation. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's another edition of Midday at the Movies with Jed Dietz, the founder of the Maryland Film Festival, and Anne Hornaday, the film critic of the Washington Post. Plus, our theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will review Berta, the new show at the Everyman Theater here in Baltimore. Stay tuned now for Here and Now. That's up next after the news. And don't forget The Daily Dose. That's WIPR's compendium of local stories. And the Chesapeake Connect podcast, a series of conversations that I host about the importance of regionalism. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.
You're listening to your NPR News station, member supported 88.1 WYPR.